So, I mean, this is what they're trying to do to us now. They're trying to break us. But, I mean, the thing is that I found that sometimes it was very difficult trying to organize.
Why? What kind of problems did you encounter?
Well, because they'd have these people come up and tell them that if, you know, if you get organized, you know that they're communists and, you know, that the Red Scare, you know, and that was the easiest thing to do to people. Just tell them about that they're communist union and that's the end of that, you know, and there's a lot of people that are terrified, you know, of even being anywhere near anybody. And then look at the fighting we did in the 40s, when we went to the provincial government and we said that we want an act written in that women weren't to work after midnight because there were women getting murdered, and there's no bus service. The buses don't run, and if they are, they have to go home alone. And we had about 3 murders. And we went to the authorities, and we were Local 28 then, and we said that we want to stipulate a regulation where the women cannot work after midnight, and if they do work after midnight in restaurants, they have to be supplied transportation home either by the boss or by the provincial government. If they want nurses and waitresses to work late hours, and we won that round, but then when the government changed, there was a new government in that was just thrown out the window because Nat Bailey fought that tooth and nail from the white spot because he kept his places open late. But he did offer to take his staff home. Mm-hmm. He did. He said, I'll offer it. That was when what's her name? She's in Toronto now, Emily Watts. She was our business agent. And Duncan Crux, I guess you know about him.
No, I don't. I know
that was the Commonwealth that fell through, and he was the one that hoisted $5 million and took off to the Bahamas and left everybody high and dry in the Commonwealth investments.
Oh.
And him and his son were here. Nat Bailey and the Hotel Association hired Duncan Crux as their lawyer. So he called Emily Watts an agitator. And she said, well, I would, seeing as that he's calling me an agitator, I would like to reply by calling him a shyster. So I brought the house down. It just absolutely brought the court, just absolutely, oh, everybody was whistling and applauding and everything because we won that round, you know, we won that. So the law was that the women can't work any later than 12 o'clock unless the transportation is provided. So you didn't have to work if the boss said to you, well, could you work another hour? Yes, I will, providing you give me transportation home, either taxi cab or you drive me home. But then that was ticklish too, because it was a lot of women wouldn't go with the boss, because immediately people will start talking, saying, there she's going home. See, there she is seen at 1 o'clock in the morning with the boss in the car. The girls fought that, you see. The waitresses says, no way. Why doesn't he just pay the taxi cab? We don't want to go home with the bosses. See, this was a big fight. And then it went back to, and then Bailey and all them fought again to get that reinstated. They wanted to be able to keep the women work until 3 and 4 in the morning.
Without any transportation home?
Without any transportation. They said you can always get a bus. There's lots of buses running till 3 o'clock in the morning. I've known waitresses that had to wait, they were through at 3 in the morning, had to wait till 5 till the first buses were running, and they sit in the restaurant at the end of the counter, wait to get home before they passed that law. But then that fell by the wayside, you know, after it wasn't, well, they just fought us all the way, especially Nat Bailey. I don't know what he's doing now, but he owns the Dogwood restaurant, I think, still owns the Dogwood restaurant at the PNE. I still think, He started out as a busboy, but he was the president of the Hotel Association, a restaurant association. He was, and they fought us tooth and nail on that, but it was a fight, but we won, for the time being.
When you were organizing the restaurants, what kind of conditions did people face generally? What were like the hours of work, the wages? What kind of work did people do, the people you were interested in organizing?
In the restaurants?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was dishwashers, salad cooks, salad girls, bus girls, cleaning women,
mm-hmm.
janitors, waitresses. What would be in the restaurants, and then the hotels, you'd have the chambermaids, and then there was a big jurisdictional fight over that again, where they say that the domestic, the hotel, the maids and all should belong to Local 28, you see, and then they say, well, no, they should belong to the bartenders, you know, or whichever. The bartenders were always away from us. They were always fighting us on every chance, instead of cooperating with us, because we were women, mostly women, because most of the waitresses are women. And the waiters, whenever there was a food waiter, nobody wants to work with a food waiter because they're the laziest. They'll pick up all their tips and then tell you to go and clear their tables, their stations. And the boss says, well, you heard him. You see, it was always the women that did all the dirty work. Women did all the work.
Were women conscious of that?
Oh, yes, we knew that. We knew that all along. They said, one of these days we'll organize just for them being unfair to us. We're going to walk up. I said, that's what we should do. We should take placards and walk up and down the street and say that men are unfair to women. Yes, we did. We were going to do that lots of times, you know, peaceful picketing. But when the boss heard we were going to do that in front of his restaurant, oh.
So which restaurants were you personally involved in organizing?
Well, I helped organize a Good Eats Cafe. I helped organize the Shelley Coffee Shop. I helped organize the White Lunches and a Chanticleer Lunch. We didn't get very far with that. As soon as they found out that he had one in there that was organizing, and she got fired right away before you had a chance to
mm-hmm.
get a grip on anything, you know. And then there was a few picket lines out in the White Lunch. Yeah, we organized the White Lunches. And
were many of those restaurants picketed in the process of organizing?
Well, we used to picket for unfair labor practices, that legislation really was a hard legislation to bring in.
Right.
That was one of the toughies. That was fought that tooth and nail all the time. Doesn't matter who was elected in the provincial government. But that was one of the things that was hard to establish.
When was that established?
I think in the 40s. In the 40s. I think it was in the 40s.
So you would have no legal protection for organizing if someone was fired because of unionized labor?
No.
There was nothing you could
absolutely
do?
Nothing. There was no, we weren't, we were told that. We were told that when we started to organize, we were told that you might be out there, you know, without a job. But there was some of us that didn't matter. It was getting organized that mattered, you know.
So you picketed the White Lunch. Around what issues was that?
Well, they were asking for better wages and shorter hours, because they were working 9 hours, because they were a European, they were of a Scandinavian, and he was bringing in cheap labor. He was another one that was known as bringing in cheap labor, you know, bringing in like the domestics were bringing him in from people that didn't know any better in Scandinavian countries. He was bringing them out here and working them in the kitchens long hours, and they were all being unfair, you know,
mm-hmm.
at that time. So they were all out trying to keep labor cheap. They didn't want us to organize. Of course they didn't, you know.
When you picketed places, did people generally respect those picket lines?
I would say yes. It was there. There's a few grumbling people come by and say, "Why don't you go back where you came from?" or, you know, or something like that, or communists, or they'd accuse us of being communists, right? But the, and same with the longshoremen strike. There was, I was quite little then, but I saw the Mounties on horseback hitting the strikers over the heads.
In the 20s?
Mm-hmm. No, this was in the 30s.
The 30s.
And it's the same thing with, you've heard of the boys going to, marching to Ottawa, the unemployed.
Oh, yeah.
Well, a friend of ours, he was a teacher, and a poet and an author, and his son was a 15-year-old student. He was on his way to Calgary to get a job on the farm because he was going to fine art. He was taking up fine arts come September, so he was working his way through for the school. So when he got to Calgary, he didn't know what was happening. Everything was happening so fast. There was a riot there, and he stood there for 1 minute, and the RCMP on horseback hit him over the head and split his head wide open. And he's in Essendale right now. He's still alive. Leslie would be about in his 50s, middle 50s. And I've gone up there to see him several times, and it just breaks my heart. His mother is in San Francisco, but his dad died. I don't know whether you've ever heard of him, A.M. Stephen. He was for the League Against War and Fascism and League for Peace and Democracy. And he taught at Lanes High School. Mm-hmm. And he just forbid his wife to go and see him anymore because she tried to raise money for an operation, but the injury was too deep. And this was an innocent bystander. And he was going to help to organize, you know, to the but he wasn't one of the boys that was going to Ottawa. He was just on his way to, and he got to Calgary, to the city. And he was going to apply for he applied for this job. He was hired on the farm to work on the farm for the summer. And this is what happened. And then, of course, another experience was when they tear gassed the post office and the library. We were right there that Sunday. We got up at 5 o'clock in the morning. We got my sister and I got a call from Harold Winch saying to be there. For everybody to assemble to come, and my sister ran in the Hotel Vancouver to use the phone, and they kicked her out of there. So she turned around and said to them, "Well, I've been kicked out of better places than this." And we were trying to rally as many people around as possible. And then when they were released, when they came out of the post office and out of the art gallery, we all marched down towards the Ukrainian Labor Temple, and that's where we started getting food, mm-hmm. putting food on the table, and all the organizations were there, and they tried to stop us. We were about 12 breast, and the RCMP were coming up. They were going to, but there's not much they couldn't do because it was too revealing. You see, it was mm-hmm. It was absolutely too revealing. They couldn't jeopardize themselves by acting on horseback like they did with the RCMP or with the longshore strike. And I would say in those days that the people were heartier. They were one for all and all for one philosophy, which was beautiful. It's my brother, it's my sister. We're all brothers and sisters. Every mm-hmm. one of us. And I mean, that was what's so beautiful about it. That's why that kept you going. Without that, I don't think we could have survived. You know, it's that hope.
Right. In relation to that, did you find it easier to organize working class, put it this way, restaurants in working class areas where you knew that the people coming in there would support the organization rather than maybe a cafe or a restaurant that served an upper-class, upper-middle-class population or something like that?
Oh, it was a lot easier to organize in a working-class area of restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, like, see, what they call third-class and second-class restaurants. Like the Devonshire and all those were organized later. All those were organized after we launched an organization campaign in Local 28. We just, from out of 300, three or 400, we got to 1,200. Then, as I say, then they slapped a trusteeship and we couldn't go any further. And then they changed the whole thing. And you see, they didn't want us to grow. The AFL didn't want us to grow. The bartenders didn't want us to overpower them. Instead of just saying, well, come on in, you're 1,200 strong, let's all put ourselves in the same, let's all get under the same tent. But we fought that for years and years and years, and now I said to Corson, the man that's in with the, they call himself Local 40, Life Begins at 40, I said, when we were, he said, yes, I know, he said, I can imagine what you were up against. He said, I can imagine, a bunch of men. They couldn't see past their nose, you know, because a lot of those guys are dead now, you know. They're not even around now, some of those old-timers.
Why were they so threatened by the women being in the bargaining unit?
Because a woman, that's the one of all the international unions in the United States, I would say that the hotel and restaurant, they call themselves catering industry now, they were the only ones that I know of, that we knew of, dominate women and don't want to recognize women, because they wouldn't even let us at one time in the union. I mean, that's how drastic it was over there.
Was the only union in the international, in the AFL, that would.
Well, that we know, that it was the only union that was reactionary in that regard, to my knowledge, that was anti-women.
Yet women were such a big part of its membership.
Yes, that's true. But they try to, you see, when the men no longer, you see, they were when they started, cocktail waitresses started in Seattle, and the local in Seattle said to them, you go fly a kite, because we're going to hire women, because women are we found out that working with women in the cocktail lounges, they're more practical, they're more reliable, and they don't drink as much, and we prefer them to the men. And the men fought that in the local. That was a big fight over that in the 50s. And then likewise, they didn't want it to spread here, so they didn't want the women to become in the car. And they had no choice, because there weren't any men, because the men were all out in construction. You see, all those waiters that were there in the late 40s and the early 50s, they all went into construction because there's more money. So that left the women. And they've used the women. Women have been used over and over and over and over and over again. And when you try to tell that to some women, they won't. They say that's not true. I said, in areas I'm talking about, I'm not saying that that men are all the same. Mind you, that's not being fair. But there are some good men, and it's the men that knew this and realized this were with us 100%. You see, the men that wanted to amalgamate into bring the Local 28 and the 676 in together, they agreed to what we were talking about, what we wanted to do. But they have been they're a reactionary union, very reactionary, very right wing.
What kind of work did you have to do in the 30s to service the different little shops? What did the union have to do to keep people? Once they were organized, to keep them?
Well, to begin with, we'd work on a contract. We'd start asking for better working conditions, holiday pay, and we'd keep policing these restaurants to make sure that nobody, our membership, we were constantly conscientious around our membership, because we knew what would happen if we ever start dropping. But the bartenders were out to drop us, you know. They were hoping that more and more women would get out of the industry, you know. And but then they weren't, like I say, the men just weren't going into that. They weren't interested. They were going into hairdressing, and they were going to other areas. They're going into some, perhaps into more areas where they can get more pay, because they weren't satisfied with the pay that was, you know, once they had taste of good money in construction. But we did police all our little restaurants, each and every one of them. We always made sure that we made contact. I was a shop steward. If there was any restaurant in trouble, like our boss owned three restaurants, and as soon as I found out that if one of the girls that was a shop steward there decided suddenly to quit, well, I'd run up there right away to make sure, and just put in somebody pro tem. Mm-hmm. Till we have a chance to have a meeting with the local, so that we can put somebody in charge right away. You see, we always had somebody to fall back, and sometimes that was very tough too, because the girls would come and go. You see, there was an element of girls that would come and go. There's some girls that were very, very interested, but they weren't lingerers. They wanted to travel. You see, well, they were having experience, and they wanted to go across Canada, thumb their way across. Well, you can't blame them. They were young, you know. But I remained stationary, and it worried me if one house wasn't serviced, or if we weren't. It worried me. I was always worried. I bite my nails down to worrying that, well, if we lose this house and that house, that'll weaken us, and then we'll go right back to square one. You know, it was tough. It was vigilance, constant vigilance to what it is today.
Did you do a lot of education then of your membership?
Yes, we did. We tried all that, and then of course that we'd buck, the AFL would buck us. They say, well, if you want anything to do with education, all you have to do is get in touch with us, and we'll give you pamphlets and books and things, and you don't... We don't want to have to put money. When it came to Canadian, the international, we were just a something that needed to fill their cash registers, the membership. That's all they were interested in, is a cash register union. The more members, the more dues, the better.
So that's when you say that you were used, that the women were used in that.
Oh yeah, we were used. We were constantly used, and we knew this. But, you know, they had that gangster type of union, if you know what I mean. They always did. And they're all in the hotel trades now, all through Vegas and Reno. I don't know how well organized they are there, but.
Is that because of the liquor?
Pardon?
Is that because of liquor and the relationship of liquor and the alcohol sort of industry and I guess the youth?
Well, it's political. It's all political. They're all in there. The BC Liquor Control Board and the hotel and restaurants are all in that little clique. The outlets and they've got it all controlled. It's all controlled. Well, you know. I don't know if you heard how long that one man controlled the liquor control board. He was 70 some odd or 80 when he died. He was a lone guy on the commission. He was a commissioner. He was the only one in that that had that. He was 40 or 45 years as in the liquor control board, and he controlled it. What is his name? I can't think of his name for the moment. But that's how many years he had that corralled. Mm-hmm. Nobody else could get near there to be more fair, you know, to do, like a little man might not, if a little working man went out and tried to get a cocktail bar somewhere or a restaurant with a cocktail license, he'd probably have a heck of a time getting a license. It's who you know, and what you know, who you know.
Yeah. Was turnover a big problem in organizing in the restaurants? And once you organize, do people tend to leave less?
Yeah, well, in some areas, it depends on the restaurant. A block away could make all the difference in a restaurant. Okay. There could be a key of girls that'll stay, providing they got good wages. We did. I've sat on negotiating committees in Local 28. And where the bosses, they get you, you know, they get you in they keep you there all night. They'll keep you there 24 hours. They'll bring the coffee in, they'll bring the food in, but they won't let you leave. The boss and the business agent, not the business agent, but one of the hotel and restaurant, one of the guys in the executive, when we were at the Melrose Cafe, I remember that. That was organized. That was across from the old post office. And our boss asked me, well, couldn't you go back to your membership and ask them to go back to 44-hour week? You know, we were 48 hours, then 40, then we finally got our 44-hour week. Well, then he said, couldn't we go back to 48 hours? I said, well, you can't. The law says, stipulates where you've got to work for a while. But he says, the law, that's one thing, the labor law, but we're talking about our contract. Can't you go back to your members and say they'll make more money? I said, well, we want to make the money for 40-hour week instead of having to work 44 hours a week. And he says, can't we bend your arm? I said, no, you can't bend my arm because there's no way you go back to your membership. I said, I'm telling you right now, my membership won't go for it. And I don't blame them, and I'll fight that tooth and nail. And they wanted to go back to 48 hours, then to 44. But we got 40, eventually got 40-hour work week, the same take-home pay.
That's quite a victory.
That was a victory. You know, but then, of course, they started bringing in part-time waitresses, and that took care of that. There was quite a few women. You see, this was another fight with the women, that the married women would come in and work for 4 hours, and they'd cut our throats. The girls that had to work full-time, that had to provide for their families, these girls just came in part-time. Well, they had the best station, the best uniform, the best everything. And they'd only work 4 hours, and they'd never come in the evening and work. No way. And they got all the breaks. And they didn't stick with us. They say, well, what do we care? I mean, I'm here for 4 hours. And then the boss say, well, we're going to make everybody 4 hours. Well, I couldn't live on that, on 4 hours a day. Whereas they had supplement at home. They had their husbands working. But we were single girls. And then there was a lot of married women that were working that had to work because they were a single family. You know, single, bringing up her own family. And there were women deserted all over the place, you know, and it wasn't fair. So you see, we have an element of women that fight us all the time too, you know. It's unfortunate, but there it is.
Right. Were you in negotiations a lot? Did you have the experience of being a negotiator?
No, I never know. I didn't. I could have gone into it, but I was more interested in staying in the background and seeing everything, because I can see things so much clearer from where I was than where I would be. But I was on the executive, the hotel, and the 676 bartenders. I was on the executive.
Right.
And the local joint executive board, I was
when was that?
That was in the 40s.
Right.
That was in the 40s. And it was tough because they were fighting us all the time, you know. Oh, no, that's not a good idea. This isn't a good idea. And any concrete idea we'd come up with, and, you know, no doubt Mays told you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, it was really tough. It was a battle all along, you know.
Did you try and establish hiring halls at all in the 30s? I remember reading somewhere in a contract that at some point one of the restaurants won the right for the women to be hired through the union.
Well, we had through Local 28 they were hiring them, but then when we couldn't supply the help, then they had to go outside. Well, that was in the contract, that if we couldn't supply them workers, they'd have to go outside. But then then they had to join the union. It was understood that once they came into the house to work, we gave them 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And one time we gave them 3 weeks, and then we gave them 2 weeks. So anybody will know within 2 weeks whether they're going to stay or not, whether they like the job. Then they have to join the union.
So you had a closed shop.
We did have a closed shop, yes.
And why did you try and set up a hiring hall arrangement? Was that so that you could help to make sure that people stayed inside the union?
Well, a joint council. I mean, I think the labor, the hiring of the hall was where all workers could hire through there. But you see, the all unions had their own hiring halls, which is their own hall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you hired through that hall.
Right. So, would only union shops use that, or would other employers ever use the union hiring hall kind of arrangement?
Well, the non-union places wouldn't. They would have liked to have come through, but then they had to be unionized before they could supply the union people. You see.
When you wanted to organize, would you ever sort of implant someone somewhere? Like, if you had sort of a perspective of organizing?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I was one of them.
Can you talk about the experience you had when you were?
Oh, yes. The minute you talked about unions, you'd scare them away. But I had a way of approaching them before I even mentioned union or anything. I got to talk to them, got to know them, and ask them where they're from and what are the working conditions like, where they came from, and you know, and how do they plan to stay in British Columbia. And it's a way, instead of pouncing on them, you see, you can lose people by pouncing on them. You see, people were frightened in those days. You just couldn't, not like now. You know, I mean, in those days you had to really handle everything with kid gloves, and you had to be very cautious, be careful what you said, because, but then the fighters, it was never difficult with fighters, because you know a fighter right away, almost immediately, the minute they come into work. Say if they're from another province and they got a job there and they waitressed in Calgary or say somewhere, well, they're fighters, they're all for the union, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So when you had a few people like that on your side, it wasn't too difficult, you know.
Yeah.
But we were planted in different areas. But then when I went to work at Canada Packers, that was already organized. You know, when I went to work, that was in the 50s. That was when my daughter was only 9 months old. She was, yeah.
There was the white lunch picket line, and there was the Trocadero. What about the Only? Was that another one that was hard to organize?
Yeah, well, that one, the Only Fish, the Only Foods, yeah. Only Seafoods.
Right,
yeah, too. Yeah, that was that. I didn't have as much to do with that one as some of the other girls did.
Did guys who were pro union ever come into the restaurants and help you organize?
Yes. Yes, there would be customers come in that were pro-union and would say, it's about time you girls started organizing in here. And, you know, like you have to sometimes really be very careful. But you see, some trade unions, they don't care. They'll just barge right in and they'll say, well, they could undo what you've been trying to do for a couple of weeks. Then they'd undo it, you know. You see, what you had to be very careful of was this Red Scare. That was very prominent. And trade unions were almost associated with socialism and communism, you know what I mean? Because put nearly all the trade unionists that were left-wing.
Either CP or CCF.
Or something, you know. And I was 14 years old when I first joined the CCF, you know. I mean, there was when I went to the meetings, there was old, what's his name that founded it,
oh,
Woodworth,
yeah. Right,
and which is what's her name's father, and I mean, we were a bunch of kids in the back, and they were taking us young people in as members. Yes, they were.
We were working.
Yeah, well, I mean, we were. Yes, I mean, they're the ones that try to help with the domestic. To organize the domestics. There were a group that were interested in organizing the domestics.
The CCF?
Yes, in the early days, yes. They were trade union conscious. Woodward's was, and Cameron and a few of those, and like Tommy Douglas and them, they were all trade union conscious. Everyone, the old CCF party was Harold Winch and his and our old Ernie Winch and Charlie Winch and Grace, and the whole family. We were, oh, incidentally, we were working the old English Fish and Chips, my sister and I, and Rogers, the Rogers brothers owned that. And they paid union, we were union right off the bat. It was nice working in a 100% union house. It really was. It was a wonderful feeling. They were from England, and they opened the fish and chip. And they're the ones that put your fish and chips in newspaper.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yes. They. Oh, I loved working there. I enjoyed it. It was a huge place. And the Woodward's 95-cent day. Just get out the ketchups. They said just fill up thousands of bottles of ketchup and you get going. Oh, it was busy. So my sister and I, he couldn't afford to hire both of us, so we worked 1 week. The both of us worked one. I worked the first 3 days, she worked the last three, and then we'd exchange. She'd work the first three, and then we'd split the pay rather than lay us off. But that was a good, they were good to work for, and they were CCF. They're the ones that supported the CCF for years and years and years, the Rogers brothers.
Did women talk about problems of childcare?
Oh, yes, that was upmost. I remember when we first started organizing childcare, put up childcare centers. That was done by the IWA Auxiliary, mm-hmm. and the Allied Fishermen's Auxiliary. And wherever there was help, that we needed help, they were right there. Those women were right there. And we tried to set this up, but it was very tough. What we had to fight was the Children's Aid Society. You see, I was, when I approached them in the 50s, and I said that I would like to, is it possible for me to rent a big house? And where I could bring child care so I could be with my daughter. Oh no, but you have to have a university degree for that. Now they're pleading with people, whether you have grade 5 or grade 6 or grade 7, as long as you can come in and help with the children. And this is what I try to tell them, if they had established that then, they wouldn't have been as badly off today as they are, because there would have been a lot of houses take in children. A lot of women would have taken in children. I myself, for instance, would have taken 10 that time just to help mothers. You know, somebody has to help, and I would be, but I was rejected every time, and it's very discouraging. You know, because you can give them love and understanding, you know, by having them in your place. Well, I didn't have, I had to have two bedrooms, I had to have this. And I had to have so many qualifications before they would agree to it, you know. Well, I can understand them being interested in children. Yes, that's a good idea. But, I mean, why don't they help us instead of discouraging us? You know, mm-hmm. by saying, well, they're putting out that money anyway. They're putting out some money. If they subsidize and help us, we could have done wonders in the 50s. The working mothers, because that's when the working mothers really started, in the 40s and the 50s, that's when the mothers really started going out and working and supplementing their husband's wages.
Right.
Yeah, but they were lucky they had their husband home in the evening, you know. But then there's a lot of men don't like babysitting either.
So what did women do? Did they have to work shifts?
Yes, well, I couldn't work. Well, you see, I either, when I went into the post office, I asked, and I worked afternoons at the Canada Packers, because that was more suitable for me than days, because she was still little. And you made more money on afternoon shift than you did on days. It's about a 14 cents difference. So when I was at the Hudson Bay in 58, they asked me to stay there 4 hours a day, like they didn't want me to quit. And I was getting, then it was $1.26 at the post office as casual work, and I was getting $1 an hour at the bay. So I said I couldn't get by. Well, he said, it'll be about another month, then you'll get on full time. But I said, what'll I do in the meantime? You know, what'll I do in the meantime? I have to have a job. And that, the welfare didn't supplement you then, you know, like they do now. They supplemented the working mothers by giving them $90 a month for a sitter,
mm-hmm.
80 and 90 and whatever. But I didn't get that. I didn't get those services. You see, that's why it was so tough for so many of the women in the same category as myself.
In the 1930s, when women were working, were a lot of them single or single parents? Did married women work at all during
not the too many married women worked. Some, but not very many, because there weren't that they would. They weren't hired. They were hiring mostly on single girls. They, you see, the BC Tel for years didn't hire married women because they found out that they had too much problems. There's this babysitting thing that even in the post office you could use that as an excuse for not coming to work. But I don't think you can even do it in the post office now, that the babysitting is an excuse, not anymore.
Was there like a real conscious kind of discrimination almost against married women working it during the Depression because of
no that? Because they figured that no, there wasn't that. There were some married women working, but they figured that the single girl has to work.
Mm-hmm.
And if they were taking jobs away from single girls, where are the single girls going to find jobs? And they figured they've already got one paycheck coming in, which is their husband's, and these girls have no checks period coming in. So single girls, mm-hmm. That was another battle again, you see. Women had to, they discriminated women against women, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? A lot of employers figured, well, if that woman qualified and she's, I don't care if she's married or single. But then there was a lot of single girls that could also qualify for that job, you know, just as well. But there were more single girls out always looking for jobs, you know, because married women sometimes couldn't work shift work,
mm-hmm.
you see,
mm-hmm.
whereas we could,
right?
Single girls could. I could work any shift. That didn't make any difference. But then when I found out, then when I did have my daughter, I found out that it was tough working shift work. Because how can you get the babysitter to, you know, the babysitter wouldn't go for that. They'll either babysit straight nights or straight days. But it was very difficult,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Split shifts, were you facing that?
Yeah, well, we used to waitressing, I had split shift, but I didn't have my dog. That was in the 40s. Mm-hmm. That's another thing we worked in the contract with the split shift. I had a triple split shift. I came in at 11:30 till 2:30, then I was off till 5:30, then I came from 5:30 to 8:30, and back again at 11:30 till 1:30 in the morning.
When were you three ways to sleep?
you weren't. If you want your job, you better be here, or else. It was even a union house, but it's still. He said, "I need you here. This is where my." He says, "If you come to work," I said, "Well, that's, we got to do something about that in the contract. That's out of the question." He just says, "No way can you keep those kind of hours." They still got split shifts,
mm-hmm.
and some women prefer them. But I didn't mind the one split shift, but not the triple one, not where you're there all day and all night, because it restricts you. You can't go home. You know, you got to stick around downtown. And it's very difficult, but that's one thing that I stressed in the contract. That's one of the first things we should do away with. And we did. Well, we had a split had to be within the 12 hours. And now I think it's in 10 hours, isn't it? Something like that.
Yeah. What other things did you get through the contract?